work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
I got to start with a plug for what Joanne just, she said she's going to have Nina Gerber on her show. I go to sleep every night to Nina Gerber. She's got an amazing CD of lullabies that really are, you know, very eclectic and very beautiful, and they're structured so that the first ones aren't quite as low-key, and so you kind of get in the bed with a good mood, and then you, you know, slowly they get more and more sleepy time. So I encourage you to listen to Folk Music and Beyond and listen to Nina Gerber. Anyway, okay, from that, talk about an absolute non sequitur. We're going to be talking about coroners. Coroners deal with death, but really their purpose is to find answers for the living. When the cause of death isn't clear, they figure out how someone died. Ken Holmes was the 3 times elected Marin County coroner, and in today's What's It Really Like to Be A segment, we're going to look at what it's really like to be a coroner. And sure, we're going to look at the detective side. How did she die? Was it Professor Plum with the candlestick at the conservatory? But we're also going to talk about the human side of being a coroner. What's it like to tell someone that their loved one died of a drug overdose or gang killing? How does living for decades around death change one's attitude about people, about their own life and their death? What's it really like to be a coroner? Ken Holmes is the subject of a new book called Education of a Coroner. Ken Holmes is with me. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Good evening, Marty. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for joining me. So, when you were a little boy, your grandfather was the first one who told you about the career of coroner. Why did, you know, people talk about different careers all the time. Why did that career, of all things, stick for you?
Well, it wasn't a direct thing. I had wanted to go into medicine, and my granddad knew in the town I grew up in that autopsies were done at the local mortuaries for the coroner's department. And he happened to know one of the funeral directors. And when I came home one day and announced at probably the age of 14 that I could not go into medicine because it took too many years,
right.
He said, "Have you ever thought about autopsies?" And of course, my next question was, "What is that?"
Right.
So he introduced me to a mortician, a funeral director. And from that point on, I decided, well, I can go into the mortuary field, which was a number of years less than medicine,
right,
and still be around medicine all the time. The autopsy being, I thought, one of the most interesting parts of medicine because you really get to know and understand the entire human body.
Well, why weren't you freaked? I mean, most people, especially when they're young, the thought of being around death and autopsy and all of that freaks people out. How come you weren't?
Well, again, with my granddad, we had been fishing once when I was 15, and we were in a very, very cold lake way high in the Sierras, and there was a dead body that was floating on in this lake, and my granddad knew and recognized what it was, and he rowed us over close enough that he could make sure that's what it was. Then, you know, I took a look and said, "Well, gee, what's all that about?" He is going to the phone, trying to find the phone in those days, to call the local authorities. And in the meantime, he explained to me what happens with decomposition and that sort of thing. And it just didn't freak me out. It was too interesting. I didn't even have time to think about being upset about it.
Terrific. Now, let's fast forward to your job as coroner. Your job is to determine the cause of death.
Yes.
What's a not obvious kind of interesting clue that you might get that I wouldn't notice if, you know, if I show up at a, you know, let's say a dead body, something you would notice that I wouldn't?
Well, as a for instance, and this doesn't happen very often, but if someone has had a traumatic death, say with hands over the mouth or a pillow over the face, very, very often they will chew up the inside of their upper and lower lip, and it's not really that they're chewing on them as much as the compression provided by somebody from the outside is pushing the lips down and grinding them against the teeth. And so if you just look at a person's mouth, you don't see anything, but we always, and I mean always, look inside the mouth, and inspect around the inside of the gums and the teeth, just because that's something that could be missed very, very easily, and it's a quiet clue that can take you in an entirely different direction.
Makes sense. I want to take a very specific case. I want us to feel what it's like to be a coroner. There was a woman, and she was sitting on her front porch, and she was watching her neighbor cut open a sealed, you know, those 55-gallon metal drums, and she was she was watching the neighbor cut it open with an electric grinder, and the drum exploded, and the lid flew through the air and decapitated her. How did you come on the scene? What did you do? Walk us through that.
Well, the police, of course, called us as soon as they got there and realized what had happened. This man was, I want to say, about 70 feet away and was cutting open a metal drum that he had procured from behind a chemical plant nearby, and he didn't know what kind of fumes or whatever had been in that container. And when the sparks broke through the top of the metal lid as he ground through it, it did indeed explode. And just because fate is like what fate is, this lid could have flown in 359 other degrees of a circle, but it didn't. And it traveled the distance at just the right level. And it, honest to God, it decapitated this lady sitting on her front porch.
And how did you ascertain that there was, that it really was random, and that there was this, somehow this wasn't, a homicide?
Well, first of all, the gentleman himself was, he didn't have any connection with the neighbor. He had just lived there for a very short time.
Okay.
But he absolutely had no idea what he was doing. And for whatever his purpose was for the drum, it's something that came up in that day. You could not have aimed that lid.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if you were Blackstone.
Right, right.
You could never aim that kind of an explosion and have that result.
Okay, so let me take another case that maybe was a little more gumshoeing. You know, I know you're not the detective, but you're there to determine the cause of death. Now, there was a foot in a shoe, and that's all. It washed up on a beach in Marin, yet eventually you were able to identify the person and determine how he died. Walk me through that.
Yes. Well, because of where it was found, there was a probability that this person had jumped from the Golden Gate Bridge, simply because of the travel from where the bridge was to where the foot was found. Actually, it was found on Angel Island. And so we went through all of the known confirmed people who had jumped in the previous some months and didn't have anybody that was even close. And so we advertised literally in the local newspapers, including the Chronicle, and put in an ad because the shoe was a particular brand of it was a Rockport. It was a particular style, I mean. And so, we put this thing in the paper after about a month or month and a half of getting absolutely no closer to who it might be. We put it in the paper that it was probably somebody who had jumped from the Golden Gate Bridge and they wore this specific shoe. Well, a coworker in San Jose, who lived in San Jose but worked in San Francisco, a coworker saw the article and called us immediately and said, one of my coworkers has been missing for, I want to say it was 7 weeks, but I'm not sure. And he always wore those kinds of shoes. So we then went to that man's apartment in San Francisco, and we were able to pick up his hairbrush, his toothbrush, and some other things to confirm a DNA sample. And the sample matched that of the tissue in the shoe.
Yeah, and so there was no crime committed. But let's talk a criminal case now. So, and they can be really complicated. So, tell us about the case of Ana Valiente and Gregario Mendez de Leon.
Well, that was complicated.
Right, that's why I picked it.
So, Ana was a very impressionable 17-year-old immigrant from Mexico. And she was working at one of the larger firms in Marin County, which also employed some other people from her nationality. And in the course of things, she got to know one of the co-workers who was a man in his, I believe, in his late 40s. And they struck up a bit of a relationship and eventually had a romantic relationship. And ultimately, she found that she was pregnant. And she was living with some friends in Marin County, but of course was certainly not anticipating anything like motherhood at that stage of her life. So she went to the gentleman and said, hey, we're going to have a baby. And he said, well, that's going to be a problem. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here. That's going to be a problem because I have a wife and children here, and I really don't want to have any more kids. And so they went back and forth over apparently 2 or 3 days, and eventually he asked her to go for a drive after work. They got into an argument. They were parked in a business area of San Rafael, and at some point, apparently, he told her that he was married and that he was not going to help her with the baby and that sort of thing. It got out of hand. It escalated, and he took out a pocket knife and, sitting next to her in the front seat of a small sedan, he stabbed her, and then he stabbed her several times, and she died sitting in the car right next to him. He, not having anticipated any of this, it wasn't like he had planned this out, you know, ahead of time. So he was, you know, cornered at this point. He had a lot of things he had to do in a hurry. One was to find a way to clean up his car. Another is to get rid of the body and to cover his tracks, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And over the course of 2 days, he convinced a coworker to use his backhoe and dig a hole in a sort of a remote area of the property that he worked. And he told the guy he just had to get rid of some junk and he didn't want his boss to know about it. So without telling his buddy why he wanted the hole, he convinced him to dig it and then leave. And then he had to dismember this lady to get her out of the car because she was heavier than he was and he couldn't lift her. And certainly because she had bled a lot in the car, it completely had exsanguinated in the car. She bled out in his car. And it was a very small car. So he felt that the only way for him to manage this was to dismember her. So he removed her legs while she was sitting up in the car, and he disjointed her at the hip. And he put the two legs in one large plastic garbage bag and put her in the other, or another plastic garbage bag, and he took them out, put them into this hole that his buddy had dug, and then he covered it all up and covered it with leaves and rocks and everything to make it look like nobody had been there. His other issue then was to get rid of the car, because that's what he commuted to and from work with, and so he found another buddy who worked at a car crushing place and told him he had a car that wouldn't pass smog and couldn't afford to do much with it, so would his buddy mind crushing it for him? So the buddy did. You know, I mean, that's not an unreasonable request.
So how in a million years would you have solved this? Now we get to the real punchline. How did Ken Holmes, coroner, solve this case?
Well, it actually was pretty easy. I didn't solve it. The police very quickly were on to the gentleman in question, and he very quickly rolled over and said, yeah, I did it. And you know, he wasn't a hardened criminal. He was a man that found himself in a very bad circumstance. So what had to take place is, one, we had to excavate the hole very, very carefully until we found the body, because
why?
He was buried quite deep.
I thought that you know, the coroner is supposed to determine cause of death. Well, we knew the cause of death. He admitted it right away. Why do we need the coroner in this?
Well, because he could easily turn around and say, no, that wasn't me. It was somebody else, and I don't have any idea what happened.
Okay.
So, I mean, you have to be able, when you go to court, you have to be able to connect all the dots from the beginning to the end.
Okay.
So the police had video of him leaving work with her in his car the last day she was known alive. We excavated the hole like an anthropological dig, just like archaeology, and we were able to find her, and she was identifiable. And then we were able to retrieve the crushed car from a scrapyard in the East Bay, and we took it to a local fire department and had them practice with their jaws of life. Huh. And they literally took this thing apart minute by minute, and we were able to show the woman's blood. There was tissue on the seat.
Right. All right, I want to stop. Enough of that. Yeah. So if, you know, it sounds like the only way they would have found the location or this particular junkyard or whatever is that the guy admitted he did it. So he gave the information. So it wasn't that hard. He surrendered the information. Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. We're talking about what's it really like to be a coroner. We've done everything from prostitute to psychiatrist. I should say sex worker. And today we're doing coroner. We leave no stone unturned here. Work with Marty Nemco here, and it's new time, Thursdays from 7 to 8 p.m. I'm talking with Ken Holmes. He's the subject of the new book, Education of the Coroner. Now, I don't want at all begin to make light of any of this. We're kind of, it's kind of gallows humor. Tell me about a particularly heartbreaking case that you were involved in.
Well, there are so many, it's difficult, but one that comes to mind, an elderly woman was driving her 12-year-old granddaughter to school one morning after a series of heavy rains, and this was some years ago. Mm-hmm. I want to say in the early 90s when we had all those torrential rains in Marin County, and they were traveling through an area where there's a lot of tall redwoods in a rural part of Marin County. Little girl was riding in the back seat. Grandmother was driving in the front seat of a foreign sedan. It was like a medium-sized Toyota. And unbeknownst to her, 80 feet away from the roadway, and this is a meandering road through the redwoods, this tree, the roots just gave, or the dirt gave up the roots, and the tree began to fall. And of course, she's in the car, doesn't hear anything because the tree is so far away. The tree was over 100 feet tall, and it bounced off of who knows how many different trees as it settled to the ground. And when it hit the ground, it landed right on top of the front of this little car. And of course, the car was abruptly stopped. The grandmother was killed instantaneously. And the little girl in the back seat bumped her head against the crushed roof and ended up with a minor bruise over her eyebrow. She's sitting in the car because now she's afraid. The car has come to a tremendous stop.
Right.
And she's saying, "Grandma, are you all right? Grandma. Yeah. I mean, it was just talking with her that morning was as horrendous as any that I can recall. There are many, but that's as bad as it gets.
I can certainly imagine. No, I can't even imagine. But think about it. Think of a little girl. She's in the most innocent of situations. She's driven to school, being driven to school by her grandma. And all of a sudden, the randomness of life means some mammoth tree crushes her. It's incomprehensible.
It
really does remind us all. We are one bad bit of luck away from calamity.
Anyway, absolutely.
Yep. Let me ask you about that now. I mean, you know, you've been doing this. You've been around death and randomness and heinous behavior and all kinds of around death in various forms for a long time. How has your attitude toward life and death changed as a result of all that, if at all?
Well, I certainly know that it has affected me in many, many ways. And primarily, I cherish every single moment with any of my family or of my close friends, my coworkers, the people that mean something in my life, because I know that I, as well as any one of them, could be snatched away by a falling tree just like I just described.
Yeah.
And over the 40-something years that I have been in this field, I have seen so much of that randomness that it's just it's mind-shattering to know that in 2 minutes, either you or I could be gone, and we don't even know what's coming. It's unimaginable the different ways that all of this can take place.
Yeah, we're going to talk some more about that. Oh, I'm sorry, please, go ahead. You wanted to say something.
So I really do cherish every single moment with anybody that is of any import to me. And I make sure that they know how I feel. that, Marty, is a real big issue because a lot of people aren't very open about their feelings with those around them, their loved ones or whoever. And if somebody's in my life, they know that I like them in my life because I don't know if I'm going to be able to tell them again tomorrow. So, I mean, that's a big part of understanding the randomness of life.
Yep. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Ken Holmes. He is the subject of the book by John Bateson, by the way, Education of a Coroner. I think in terms of moments of relationship, let's create a little relationship, dear listeners, between you and Ken Holmes. I'd like to invite you to call. If you've been listening to my discussion about what it's really like to be a coroner, Ken is here to answer your question. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's say you were having to tell a family member that a person died of an overdose. Because something I read is that Marin County actually has a very high drug abuse rate.
Yes.
So if you had to tell a family member that a person died of an overdose or of a gang murder, whatever, how would you start the conversation?
Well, the first thing I do is I do not tell them that I'm from the coroner's office because that puts everything in a very bad perspective.
For sure.
Most people can't even absorb that word when you knock on their door, either in the middle of the day or in the middle of the night. Typically, we take a uniformed officer with us so that it lends some credence to us knocking on their door or approaching their place of work, because I've had to make a lot of notifications in the workplace during the daytime. And so, you know, I approach them and ask them if they are who they are and if they are related to or know, whatever the situation is, about the person that I'm there to talk about. Because we have to make sure that we're talking to the right people. And there have been horrendous stories of when that doesn't work out properly. So, you know, I ask if we can go someplace quiet, or if we're, you know, at a home, then we'll ask if we can come in, because what we have to talk about is very serious. It's not something we want to deal with on the doorstep. And once we are inside, now they already know there's something wrong or else we wouldn't even be there. And then when I tell them why I'm there, I make sure that I use the words either died or dead in my sentencing, because if I say they're fatally injured, quite often the next question is, well, how bad are they and what hospital are they in? So, and then it goes downhill from there. It's absolutely the worst part of the coroner's job, the coroner's function, is to know that you're going into someone's home and going to ruin their lives probably for a very long time, if not forever.
We're beginning to run out of time. What I wanted to do, you know, we all are moved by stories. I want to be open-ended. Think of one story that would be revelatory of what it's really like to be a coroner that you would like to tell. I was fascinated by the story of Anna and Gregorio. Tell me one more story that would really bring light to what it's really like to be a coroner.
Well, I think one of the ones that was one of the stories that was most gratifying to me, we had a gentleman that was washed ashore in the ocean in Point Reyes in like 82 or 83, and he didn't have any identification on his person, and we spent months trying to figure out who he was, eventually could not. So we interred him at one of the local cemeteries in what is commonly referred to as Potter's Field.
Right.
And in 2004, because of the advancement in technology and the creation of the World Wide Web and all the different things that are available technologically, we were able to trace keys that we had found in his pocket, but had no idea where those could have come from and no way to know. We were able to find a key register registry on the web, and we're able to track the key, and then eventually able to talk to the locksmith who made it. He told us why and who had asked him to make those keys. We were able to double back, talk to that company. We were able to identify this 22-year-old man who was out here from Ohio literally for 2 weeks and wanted to go visit the Pacific Ocean, and he had been lost at sea in Monterey. His body was never recovered, and no report was ever filed in the missing persons because they knew he had died, and they had notified his family in Ohio. And we were able to, in the early 2000s, we were able to contact his mother and his two sisters and let them know after 23 years what had actually happened to their son and their brother. It was one of the most gratifying cases of my entire career.
Right. Providing closure is one of the better parts of your job, I guess.
Absolutely.
Let's focus on the career for a minute. I've got one kind of a last question. Let's say I was your son or other relative. And, as far as I understand, coroners, back in the old days when you first got in, you didn't need a medical degree, but now they use medical examiners more. If I were looking, and I didn't want to spend a zillion years and zillions of dollars to go to medical school, but I was fascinated about the idea of being a coroner, what would you tell me now in the year as we're getting close to 2018?
I would say to you, you are so very fortunate because today there are degrees offered in forensics. There are degrees offered in death investigation, and none of that was available when I went into this business in the 60s. And so I would strongly encourage you to, even in high school, look at all the biological classes that you can take, anatomy, pathology, physiology, anything like that, and certainly in college to follow in that direction and seek a career in forensics. And there are so many varied facets, disciplines within forensics now. There are forensic nursing, there's all these different things, the technological side of it, the toxicological side of it. It's a very fast-growing industry or discipline, if you will, and I'll tell you, for me, it was the most exciting career I ever could have even thought of.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end our discussion. Hey, you did a great job, Ken. It was really a pleasure having you as a guest on Work with Marty Nemko. The book is The Education of a Coroner. My guest is not the author. My guest is the subject. He is the coroner. A guy named John Bateson wrote the book, but I commend it to you. It's really fascinating reading. Ken Holmes, thanks again for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. I appreciate it.
Very good. Oh, absolutely. Right. Okay, and now we turn to you. If you have a work-related problem of any sort, you or someone you care about, whether you're 16 or 76, whether you are unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, those are all people of all stripes have work-related problems, I invite you to call for what I call a workover. It's simply you call in, I ask you some questions, and hopefully give you a step or three in the right direction. The phone number here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko for that workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The United States government just released its latest projections for its fastest-growing occupations, and it has lots of interesting implications. They are... I'm going to just simply read them, and then I'm going to comment. Solar installer, wind turbine installer and technician, home health aide, personal care aide, physician assistant, nurse practitioner, statistician, physical therapist assistant, software developer, mathematician, bicycle repairers, medical assistants, and physical therapist aides. What are the implications? There's more. There's some more, but I'll read you the last few, too. Occupational therapy assistants, information security analysts, genetic counselors, operations research analysts, forest fire inspectors and prevention specialists, health specialty teachers, and derrick operators in oil and gas. What strikes me as interesting commonalities is the absolute explosion in the number of what are called intermediate care providers. Notwithstanding Donald Trump, we are moving toward covering what's being called here in the Bay Area, especially Medicare for All. And that is meaning that if we're trying to cover everybody, and it's going to be a lot of people who are currently not covered, who are low income but have high needs, there's got to be a way to stretch the dollars somehow. And so that's what's projecting all of this growth in physician assistants, home health aides, nurse practitioners rather than MDs, physical therapy assistants, medical assistants, physical therapy aides. So that's really where the growth is going to be, for sure. Of course, on the other end, there is this high-end, high-tech stuff, which is, you know, statisticians and security programmers and software developers. I'm always worried about the middle. There are zillions of people who either don't have college degrees but can't afford to live on $15 or $18 an hour, and or who are not going to get a PhD in machine learning and deep learning and artificial intelligence. What's going to happen to them? That's a real issue. The other thing is, you know, the data that gets produced by the government is retrospective. They say the title of the document is Fastest Growing Occupations 2016 to 2026, but it's all retrospective. And so, for example, they list as the number one occupation solar installer. Well, on the ground in the year 2017, I've had a couple of clients who were aspiring solar installers. And what they've told me on the ground here in the Bay Area, which is the epicenter for solar, of course, is that if you're just a beginner, you're not hireable or minimally hireable. Only if you're really advanced and can do the complicated installations, then they want you. So, and this is the supposed number one fastest growing field. So the big takeaway I have for you, dear listeners, is I would encourage you to not necessarily look at these government statistics because they're so retrospective. But I, as those of you who have traveled with me from my previous 28 years of Sunday time to this know that I try to never bring up a problem without a solution. So I thought about how can I do better than those government statistics? How can I be not retrospective but prospective? Well, this week, last week, LinkedIn put out a list of the 50 industry disruptors right now. These are startups. And this is much more prospective. This is where the world seems to be heading. So I think in the next 5 minutes, I'm going to be able to give you a pretty good window into where the really, where the good jobs and where the industries are growing, etc. Some of these are not going to surprise you. They're listed in order. I'm going to read the top 25. Uber, no surprise. It's been in the public eye for all the wrong reasons, sexual harassment claims, regulatory issues, all kinds of stuff. People are claiming that it's avoiding giving benefits to people. But they've got 16,000 people working for them. Unfortunately, most are low pay. And they also, you know, it's interesting how LinkedIn describes them as the global headcount. It doesn't say that that's the number of jobs in America. So many of the jobs, especially in the tech area, are offshore. Number two is, again, not surprised, Airbnb. And they are on track to pass 100 million guest arrivals this year. So again, technology, practical, disrupting the standard ways of, for example, buying a room rental. I mean, hotel rates are bizarre. $200 or $300 a night are not uncommon, sometimes $400. Well, there's all this vacant space that people have that'd be happy to rent out space in their place or their entire place. It's changed everything. It's made nice places affordable to the working and middle class that didn't exist. Number three, WeWork. This is a place that takes spaces and makes them available for workers. Kind of a commercial, less fancy, less expensive way for small businesses to rent locations. Great new idea again. That's number three. But again, it's all digital. It's all online. They do have a basis here in San Francisco, but almost everything goes online. Number four is Lyft. Again, I won't say any more about that. Obviously, the competitor to Uber. Slack. This is something that is a business-to-business thing you may not have heard of, but they've got a $5 billion valuation. This is a very fast-growing company. What they do is they are trying to go head-to-head with, like, Microsoft to allow workers to message each other in real time. I don't know how, I don't quite understand it, but it's huge. Then the next, number six, is NIO. NIO is a Shanghai-based company with 2,000 employees worldwide, and they're developing smart electric and autonomous vehicles. It started and expanded, at least to the U.S., a couple of years ago. It has built the world's fastest electric car, able to go from 0 to 60 in 2.7 seconds. The CEO was formerly of Cisco. He says NIO cars are going to be available in the U.S. as soon as 2020. Number 7 on the list of fast-growing companies, again, I'm reading you these or telling you about these, I'm trying to paraphrase and not read, are designed to give you a better feel, a prospective feel for what the world of work is really like now and in the future, rather than the government statistics, which are based on old data, even though they're saying it's projected forward. Number 7 on the list is a company called Rubrik. And Rubrik is like Visa for enterprise. It's a it helps companies organize their data in the cloud so that you can get instant access for recovery and analytics. It's a corporate business-to-business thing. They got 600 workers. Again, it's global. I don't know how many in America. But that company, which seems like a niche business, worth its valuation is $1.3 billion. Dropbox. We all know about Dropbox. It's a cloud storage for your backup for your hard disk, or if you want to send big files that you can't send through email. Number 9 is Houzz, H-O-U-Z-Z. Again, it's a way to disrupt the way in which people buy furnishings, home decorating stuff online. I don't need to say more than that. It's 1,400 people worldwide. Number 10, Convoy. Convoy is a company that's trying to enable independent trucking companies to match with people who want trucking online to make it easier to match up independent truckers with companies that need trucking. I'd like to give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has a work-related problem, I invite you to call. I do what I call workovers. For those of you just joining us, the show has been on for 28 years on Sundays. It's now been moved to Thursdays. And so if you've got a work-related problem of any sort, frankly, the harder the better, I welcome your call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Number 11 on the list of what LinkedIn is calling the current industry disruptors. This came out this month, in November. General Assembly. General Assembly is a company that is creating short-term, highly intensive courses for training people in data science, in web development, and it's really potentially has enormous potential to be disruptive because the universities just tend to not be current because a professor, for example, who has tenure has been around a long time and may not be that interested in the cutting edge except perhaps in his or her little niche area, which may not be what tomorrow's web developer or data scientist needs to know. I'll do some more after if we've got time, but what I'd like to do is go to the phones. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello, it's you. Are you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. What gives me the honor of your call?
The job thing. In fact, I'm trying to land myself a job. I'm restructuring my career.
Okay.
And I'm back into engineering after a span of been gone for a few years. And then I've gone and taken some classes. And I'm surprised on that list with LinkedIn, you didn't have stuff, anything to do with high tech like blockchain, which seems to be taking over financial sector.
I didn't hear that last word. What was the word that you didn't mention? What was that word that's taking over the financial sector? What was that?
The blockchain technology.
Oh, yeah. That's still considered
Bitcoin and all that stuff. And I was hoping that job's opening there because that's what I'm trying to get.
It's still considered fairly marginal. The core belief about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin is that right now that it has to be able to. People have to believe in the all those that network of computers that comprise the Bitcoin network more than the United States government. Because right now, if you have a dollar, it is backed by the U.S. government. If you have a stock, it's backed by the SIPC, even though it may go up and down. People believe the U.S. government can be around a lot longer than necessarily the cryptocurrency. So it's very exciting to many people because they want to screw the banks. They say, we want to get rid of the banks. We want to move the middlemen out of there. But it's still pretty marginalized. So it's you know, there is a company that I just mentioned, I haven't actually. It's called Stripe. and it's developing a new cryptocurrency to be competitor to Bitcoin called Stellar, but it's still fairly marginal. What kind of engineering, you're going back to, but there's a million kinds of engineers from civil to electrical. What kind of
electrical? Electrical, and it's not so much about the currency, don't get me wrong. It's the infrastructure. A lot of banks, even Goldman Sachs, is investing heavily in the blockchain technology.
That's true.
Somebody was talking about earlier about IBM and all these other companies investing heavily, and I think those are the jobs are going to be the next frontier, especially in technology. So, yeah, what the chain can do or what these chains, these blockchains can do for us with the ledgers and all that sort of thing is what I'm really, really interested in.
Okay. Well, fair enough. So let's talk about, I mean, we know that the way we get trained today is completely different. We don't usually go back for a master's degree. So you've taken courses. Have you been doing self-study? Are there articles and books that are on programming for, I mean, like you say, very often in cryptocurrencies are not going to be just used for a means of exchange, but a means of accounting. Do you feel you're currently ready to look for a job in that space, or do you have more learning to do?
I think I really am. I've taken a bunch of classes, a bunch of Coursera classes that are also
right.
really good. There are a lot of good books written out on cryptography, and even just the blockchain technology and the cryptocurrencies, not so much about the currency itself, but about the infrastructure, which is,
right.
I think, the
dear listeners, deal. Notice now, every people, and when we're talking about getting trained and educated, we're no longer saying Berkeley, Stanford. We're saying Coursera, which may
right.
have some courses that maybe have been taught by a Berkeley or a Stanford professor, but this is what's really disruptive. Education and training is changing dramatically. So have you looked at, there have been articles that talk about coding tests in that space. Have you read the articles on the coding tests that tend to be asked for in the cryptocurrency space?
Yeah, and that one big book that, no, that's not in the cryptocurrency space. It's just the book I was going to mention. It's actually just in coding. I don't know of any coding test in cryptocurrency space.
Articles. I think isn't it coding the hard way or something? What's the name of the name of that book for coding?
I don't know. It's written by some lady. I can't remember what it's called. But yeah, the Green Big Book. Yeah.
Okay. So, what is your question for me?
How do I approach it? I mean, especially being out of industry, back in industry, got some knowledge under my belt, can code.
Portfolio. When you don't have a degree, you've got to show some of the segments of code that you've created, especially in those spaces, especially in the ledger space. It would be very important for you to have some samples. They don't have to be big programs. I'm not saying you do. But whether you're using a current language, whether it's Microsoft Enhanced R or Python, use something that is currently hot these days. Use it in the Spark platform if you can access to that. Those are the kind of buzzwords that people are reacting well to. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So when you've got that portfolio, and again, there is a tremendous desire these days to have more women in this field. And so organizations like Women in Technology, WITI, and other especially women's technology and software companies may be the kind of place where you could spread your portfolio around, and they may give you an open door into some jobs. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And those are my two best pieces of advice. I wish you luck, and thank you very much for reminding me. I did hear that a few months ago, that yes, the Goldman Sachs's and IBM's of the world are investing in Bitcoin infrastructure just in case. So thank you very much for that gift to us.
Thank you.
Take care. And I now invite you again to call. If you've got a work-related problem, you don't need to be technical like that. I'm really not that technical. A good career counselor knows a little bit about everything, a lot about nothing. So I knew just enough to have a conversation with her. So you don't have to be a techie to call. Whatever your career problem, technical or not, hopefully I can at least add a little value. Certainly the price is right. Zero, zippo, nada. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I have been talking about these industry disruptors that really hopefully give us a better window into what the world of work is really looking like prospectively, rather than the just released statistics from the government, which is retrospective, although the article is called The Fastest Growing Careers for 2016 and 2026, it's retrospective. I want to just, before I've got calls on the line, but I want to, I briefly mention that company, Stripe. Stripe is a very interesting company. They are trying to, again, revolutionize online payments. It's a very complicated, very crowded field now. I mean, it started with PayPal, and then, you know, Venmo and a bunch of others, and Stripe is trying to enable, for example, to use Bitcoin as a currency, and it's even, as I said, developed its own. So that's Stripe. Again, that's where the future is. I'll give out the phone number one more time. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, if you want to work over, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I promise, the next startup I'm going to mention has nothing to do with technology. But for now, let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi. So I was just listening to you, and I kind of made this call on a whim, but I'm in my mid-20s, and right now I'm working in technology consulting, and I'm mm-hmm. looking to make a huge switch. What I studied in my undergrad was environmental policy. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of looking to get my foot in the door in that realm now, but I'm getting a little bit overwhelmed because the background where I've been spending my past 3 years working has been so different, and it's been kind of more IT-focused. So I'm kind of looking for some advice on what you would think is the best way for me to shift into now something like environmental policy, which is completely different.
Two things you need to do. You probably first need to leverage that technology consulting background first, because there's a lot of people who want to make policy, you know, let's restrict pollutions, let's build fewer freeways, you know, that's all well and good, but there's a million of those wannabes. You've got a harder to have attained technical chops, so you've got to find the interface between, pardon the pun, the interface between technology and environmental policy. So where are your tech chops the strongest?
Well, I'm working with SaaS platforms right now. I know a bit of basic coding, but my true background kind of lies in customer experience management, which basically means if a customer comes to a company with an issue, I know how to quantify that into a number and then help companies convert that using a specific SaaS platform into something where they can change their business goals going forward.
So are you a good infographics person? Are you a way to translate that data into, you know, very comprehensible sound bites, or is that further downstream than you?
I think that's more downstream than I've been exposed to, but I think I could probably get my hands wet in data visualization or something like that.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, you know, if I am trying to make policy, people are convinced by two things, stories and visuals. And so if you could gain a little technology, a little knowledge there on how to translate data, you know, SAS is a big database. You're extracting data from this massive database. So if you could use that SAS skills to, A, extract data, for example, regarding some environmental policy, maybe the public's willingness to accept sitting in gridlock in exchange for the environmental benefits or whatever, that you can take that data and not just translate it into text, but if you could bring that into the visual space, you're now bringing more to the table, and you can then go to every nonprofit and governmental environmental policy entity and say, hey, I can do this piece of it for you that will enable you to make the kind of policies that I guess that you, my caller, and the nonprofit wants. Does that make sense?
I think so. So basically what you're saying is use the tech skills that I have to kind of find some data that's related to the environment and then create some sort of visualization that will then help shape policy. So then I kind of take it to, I don't know, like policymakers, local congressmen, something like that.
I'm saying that's going to be, you're going to create one as a sample, as proof of concept. Like when I go to Costco and they give me a free meatball, they want me to buy 10 pounds worth. So you're going to create a sample of, you're going to find a data set of some sort that's related to the environment. You're going to query it using, you know, whatever your SQL queries or whatever. And you're going to take that data and you're going to have it in text form, in tabular form, and also as an infographic. And you're going to send that around and say, I am an environmentalist. I'm very interested in environmental policy. But I'm not just another, you know, placard-waving environmentalist with a BA from Santa Cruz in environmental studies. I've got tech chops and I can bring that to bear. And here is some sample of what I did to take a database that it was a disembodied bit, a set of bits and bytes, converted it into numbers, into tables, and into a very compelling infographic. Can I be of use to you? And then you go to your network of people who are in the world of environmental stuff as well as, ideally, who also have technical chops and say, this is what I bring to the table. Do you know somebody I should talk with? And simply in answering ads, you answer ads for all the environmental nonprofits as well as government agencies, and you say, oh, in addition to my resume and LinkedIn profile, here is a link to my portfolio. Here's a link to my sample. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like that. Cool. That was very helpful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemko. I'll give out the phone number one more time. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, again, I've been being quite technical. It's unusual for me to be this technical. Again, I would encourage you, whatever your issue is regarding career, and it can be really, I have no aversion whatsoever. If you are, you're a nanny and you want some guidance about, how to do that, or you're into fashion, whatever it is, from the most technical to the least, I usually can help. The phone number here for a workover, again, the price is right, zero. And KLW makes this free, available to you, and it is my pro bono work for you. So the phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I promised you that I was going to tell you about one of the fast-growing startups that is not technical, and that's called Glossier. There was the CEO of Glossier, her name is Emily Weiss. She ran a popular blog called Into the Gloss, and she then kind of became an expert at, I guess it's cosmetics. It's such a hit. The company's been only around since 2014. Its products sold out and had a wait list of 10,000 people long for her stuff. Its annual growth rate is 257%. So even in cosmetics, a low-tech thing, it's one of the top disruptors in LinkedIn's top companies. Again, I'm trying to give you a perspective on the future. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, I'm actually calling on behalf of my sister, who
Great.
I feel like I've been trying to help since she's been in the working world. She works in nonprofits mainly, and has been bouncing from nonprofit to nonprofit trying to find her niche.
Mm-hmm.
And she's finding that there's a lack of resources, and management isn't always available to delegate projects to her. So I'm trying to figure out how to help her either manage up or what she can do to take on projects when they're not being given to her and she wants that responsibility.
What is she, more of a word person, people person, data person?
She's a people person.
Well, mm-hmm. Normally when I hear the word, I'm always hearing from the word nonprofit, there are resources aren't available. So that's true. People think that the business's lifeblood is money, but nonprofit's lifeblood is money too. And when somebody is trying to get a more substantive job in the nonprofit sector, if she is a people person, the mm-hmm. smartest way for her to get in is to become a fundraiser. And again,
sure, yeah.
Right. And so taking short courses through the Foundation Center or community colleges, again, online courses on the art of fundraising, whether it be to individuals or fundraising to try to hit up corporations or fundraising. The big kahuna is getting rich people to leave the nonprofit in their will.
Mm-hmm.
If she can come in with those kind of chops, that may be her way to get her, because those kind of projects, if she can make a compelling case for how she's got a targeted approach to maybe a certain kind of companies or whatever that she's going to go after, that's the kind of project that's more likely to get a yes than a project to help the homeless or whatever, because that is what's called a cost center.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to find ways to causes, to good causes to give to. It's not as easy to find ways to make money. Especially if she's been bouncing around a lot and not landing something, and you say she's eager to have a project to run, it seems to me it should be something more like that. And if she's not a fundraiser type herself, The fundraising operation has a lot of behind-the-scenes people. They have researchers called prospect researchers who do research on a given CEO and what that CEO's hot buttons are, so that when the pitcher, the guy or woman who's going to make the ask, goes and asks, they know the psychographic profile of that donor and can get big money. Or somebody who's an event planner who can put on the big fancy gala for $500 a plate to raise money. So there are people in the fundraising operation who are not necessarily the askers. Which kind of, and there's also database people, back to the tech thing, who run the donor database. Which of those feels like your sister?
She has done, it sounds like she's done a little bit of all of that. She has gone after certain donors. She's done a lot of fundraising. She has put on events. They haven't necessarily been as large as you're describing, but she seems to have done a little bit of all of that. But she still hasn't managed to just land in the field.
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, would the goddess say that one of those is her gift? Which is she really the best at?
She's the best at dealing with people.
Okay, so not the events. So making the ask. Now, if she's bounced around a lot, sometimes that's random and just your bad luck, but sometimes either she's a pain in the butt to deal with or she's just not that competent, or she's lazy, or she hasn't done a good enough job of vetting the particular nonprofits and she's ended up with really poorly run ones. What, if you're really being honest, what do you think is the reason she hasn't landed a place?
I think it's honestly been a culture issue that maybe she wasn't expecting when she got into the nonprofit world.
Tell me more.
Just a different culture. She is probably best with structure and being able to go after a project and take it on and run with it. And in this type of structure, it seems like there isn't, it's not always super structured. There's maybe a looser structure and more of a casual culture.
Okay. Well, when structure is the required, normally it's the larger nonprofits that have been around long enough to have developed processes and procedures. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if she's gone after smaller ones. When you talk about kind of unstructured, loosey-goosey, informal, that sounds small. Has she focused on larger nonprofits?
Not recently, but it might be something to consider.
That makes sense. All right, I'm looking up at the clock, and that is all
Thank
the time
you.
We've got. Okay, you take care. I've got a few seconds left, so I want to just summarize the other 20 of the rest of those 25 industry disruptors that LinkedIn is talking about. Certainly, data security is huge. You know, you hear about all of the intrusions into the government databases, our privacy, companies. So there's no question that cybersecurity, and of course the Russians' involvement, cybersecurity is huge. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and calling in, especially since you perhaps have migrated with me from 28 years of Sunday. It's hard to break an old habit. But we're here now every Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. I do encourage you to join me next week. I will. You can call in for a workover. And I will talk with Julie Dirksen about smart ways to learn on the job and to teach others. Until then, it is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.